I've discovered something a bit crazy during this pandemic.
What?
So like a lot of people, I've been spending quite a lot of time on Zoom calls. And we realized recently that if someone flushes the toilet in this household, the Wi-Fi cuts out and I fall off the call. Isn't that crazy?
That's really strange and doesn't really make any sense. Why should flushing a toilet be connected to electricity or Wi-Fi signal?
I don't know. But if anyone has any insights into why that may be the case, let me know. It's very intriguing.
Sounds like it might tie into some conspiracy theory, I reckon.
It's real. How are you?
I'm fine. I actually had quite like an eventful few days. I had to help a friend move house. So it felt like the most social contact I've had in decades. And you know, in Amsterdam, we move house through the window with these like pulleys and ropes.
Oh, yeah.
If you've not seen it, you should Google it. It's like quite extraordinary and quite terrifying because they decided to put the British person in charge of making sure the huge pieces of furniture don't smash against the windows of the flats below. And oh my God, there was a really near miss with an enormous 2 meter long sofa almost crashing into the window of the flat below. But I just about survived it.
Well done.
Thank you. Anyway, it was the most excitement I've had in months. You also did a podcast this week without me.
I did. Yeah, I wanted to tell people about that. I hosted a podcast for the United Nations. I'm moving up in the world, Dominic.
So grand.
See ya. No, it's a really nice podcast by UN Women. It is called Generations Talk Gender, and I hosted the first episode ever, which is very cool. The idea is to have like intergenerational conversations between feminists, and this is a very interesting conversation between a young Romanian activist and a older activist in Serbia, talking about violence against women. So check it out.
Sounds really interesting. I will.
What are we talking about this week?
This week, we're interviewing Ola Chihovlas, a journalist at AFP, the French press agency, where Katie works as well.
Well, used to. Oh. We'll be working again very soon.
Who's here to tell us the extraordinary and like Hollywood-worthy story of her grandmother, Yanina Garbian, who sadly died recently at the age of 95. And she had one of those pan-European lives that's so full of extraordinary tales that it seems incredible that we don't all already know about her. She was, as Ola describes, an unsung hero, and we're here to help Ola shout it from the treetops this week.
Shout it from the treetops? That's not a phrase.
I'm so bad at idioms. Shout it from the rooftops.
I like it. It's a more natural version of shout it from the rooftops.
Am I mixing my metaphors? No, it's not even a metaphor. It is a metaphor. Is it a metaphor? Ah! Who's had a bad week, Katie?
It's been a bad week for French police brutality. A lot of you would have seen this already because it went pretty viral. The weekend before last, a Parisian music producer named Michel Zecler was just arriving at his studio when he saw a police car outside. And Michel didn't have a face mask with him. So he thought, oh, okay, I'll just step inside quickly because I don't want to get a fine. Masks are obligatory everywhere outside home at the moment in Paris. That was all he'd done wrong. He was a black man who had forgotten to bring a face mask. And what followed was a vicious beating by three police officers in the lobby of the music studio. Michel said they also used the French version of the N-word repeatedly. And the police later tear gassed and beat up several young musicians who'd been recording in the studio basement.
It's awful. What's the reaction been like to this?
Yeah, so it's caused a national scandal. This is far from the first time that a black man in France has been the victim of completely unjustified violence on the part of the police. But what made this incident particularly chilling was the fact that the police officers lied about what happened because they didn't realise they were being filmed. So after the beating, Michel was arrested and taken to the police station. And the officers who had beaten him up, they wrote a statement saying that he had attacked them and they had been forced to defend themselves. Now, they had no idea when they wrote the statement that the whole thing had been captured on camera, both the CCTV inside the music studio and neighbours filming from across the street. And it was the video footage that made it clear that this assault had been completely unprovoked. As Michel said himself, without this video, it would have been his word against the cops. And in such cases, who is going to believe him against respectable officers of the law? Why does this matter so much? Obviously, it's awful in itself, but it also came at a time of really intense debate about the role of the police in France. And that is because the government has been trying to pass an extremely controversial new law that would really heavily restrict the filming of police officers. So you wouldn't be able to publish any photographs that identify an officer, apart from his ID number or her ID number. And if you did publish any photos that identify a police officer, you could get fined €45,000 or spend a year in jail.
Ugh.
However, MPs from Macron's party have just announced, because of all the controversy over this, that they are going to rewrite this part of the law, or try to.
Is that in response to the fact that this awful thing has just happened? Like, if this hadn't happened and hadn't been filmed, would this law have passed?
Yeah, I think it would have done. So it had already passed the lower house of parliament, and it was currently going through the Senate. And the idea behind it was basically to allow police officers to do their job in the knowledge that they're not going to get harassed in their private lives by people who have a grudge against the police or against that particular officer and might, I don't know, like find out where they live or something, or send them threatening messages on social media. And I do get that. But the problem is that this law could have made it potentially much more difficult to document police brutality. The only reason that we know about this horrific assault on Michelle is because it was filmed. And the same goes for another incident that's caused a big scandal over the past week, also in Paris. Law enforcement cleared this big migrant camp in the city centre in a frankly appalling fashion. They fired tear gas at the migrants, they chased them out of their tents, and of course didn't offer them any alternative housing. They just wanted to get rid of them from out of sight, out of mind, I guess. So that plus the assault on Michelle, it was two cases in a week that showed just how important it is for people to be able to document the way that police behave. And I want to say, of course, that, you know, most people do not become police officers because they want to beat people up. Michelle himself said, you know, I have friends who are cops and I have a huge amount of respect for them, but their job is to protect us. And one way we can make sure they're doing that and not abusing their power is to be able to film what they're doing in public without worrying that filming them is going to put me in prison. And a lot of people were very worried about this. More than 130,000 people protested against it this weekend, this new security law. And it is partly because of that overwhelming public response that Macron's party have now said, OK, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. We're going to try and rewrite it.
How was it ever a good idea? I mean, everyone's known police brutality is a serious problem in France. I mean, we talked about it on this podcast about 6 months ago, didn't we? And oh, it's so depressing. Is this a sign that... It's the fact that Macron tried to pass this law a sign that his government is shifting towards being more of a right-leaning authoritarian party, or is that too much to take from this?
Yeah, there's a big conversation going on about this at the moment. Can we even call... We've always called Macron's party a centrist party and called him a centrist. But of course, with the whole conversation about Islam that's going on and now this new police law, it did feel a lot like they were shifting rightwards. A lot of people see Macron's interior minister, Gérald Darmanin, as the sort of... the main sort of right-leaning force within this government, the person that is really pushing that move towards the right. And he, interestingly, at the protests was the target of quite a lot of the ire on the signs and things. There was one, it's not really funny. No, it is funny. I'll tell you about it. There was a very funny sign that was photographed a lot at the protests that said, Damana Kakabuda, which basically means Damana poo-poo head. It's very funny. But yeah, it does feel like a rightwards shift. There is going to be a presidential election coming up, not that far from now. So perhaps, this is the speculation, perhaps it is a shift towards the right to try and harness that right-wing vote. But for now, at least, it feels like they've got the message. Macron's party, La République En Marche, has got the message on this part of the law. And they are trying to completely rewrite it, which is a good outcome, I guess. Although it's not really clear how they're going to rewrite it, because they don't actually have control of the bill anymore. So it's already passed through the lower house of parliament. They voted in favour of it and they sent it to the Senate. So they need to try and get it back.
Give it back.
Yeah, it's like when you send an email and you're like, no, it's sent and I want to change something. How do I do that? It's probably worth saying that apart from the massive protests that showed very clearly that people were not okay with this, Macron was apparently very upset about the assault on Michelle. He'd written this long Twitter thread saying that it was appalling and the police needed to be exemplary. And he also said in the tweets that press freedom was really important. In the meantime, the officers who beat Michelle up, they've been suspended from their jobs and charged with assault and with fraud for lying on their statement. And Michelle himself is doing his best to recover. He's had to have stitches in his head and he is covered in bruises and I imagine still very traumatized.
Yeah, a lot of sighing happening over here.
A lot of sighing. Cheer us up. Who's had a good week?
Yeah, I can cheer you up with this one, actually. It's been a good week for the town of Fucking after their municipal council voted to change the name of the place they called home to Fugging. Yes, Fugging with two G's instead of Fucking with C-K.
Just to clarify, it is Fucking. F-U-C-K-I-N-G. That's the name of the village.
Yes, that is the name of the village currently, and it will be changing on the 1st of January 2021.
I think this is bad news. I like the old name.
Well, bear with me. It's potentially good week for the people in the village. It's a little village that's north of Salzburg, and there are only about 100 people that live there. They were so fed up with the constant mockery, the pranks, the social media attention, and decided that changing the name was the only way to deal with it. And actually, I can understand why their sense of humor about the name was wearing thin. The street signs were regularly being stolen because everyone obviously wants a street sign that says fucking. And they had to start installing expensive thief-proof signs with heavy concrete bases. And it also seemed to annoy local residents that there's a pretty constant stream of tourists who make the journey to the town simply to have photos in front of the sign, often whilst making some obscene pose, or in some cases, even going the whole hog and doing the fucking in front of the fucking sign.
Wow.
Yeah.
Doing it for the gram.
Yeah. And apparently the locals have been suffering with this for quite a long time now. It started going wrong around the Second World War when some American and British soldiers who were stationed near Salzburg heard about this town called Fucking and started making the pilgrimage to go and check it out. It's obviously become a lot worse since the internet became a thing, and I'm ashamed to say that it seems to be Brits who cause the most trouble. No surprise there, I guess.
Come on, fellow nationals. What are you doing?
There's a great quote from a local tour guide that was in the Sunday Telegraph 15 years ago. Yes, I did some deep dive research into this story.
Well done.
He said, "The Germans all want to see the Mozart House in Salzburg. Italians and Russians always celebrate New Year here. Every American seems to care only about The Sound of Music, which was filmed in Salzburg. The occasional Japanese wants to see Hitler's birthplace in Braunau. But for the British, it's all about fucking."
How did it possibly get a name like this in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. The history is a little bit unclear, but locals trace it back to the 6th century when there was a nobleman called Focko, F-O-C-K-O, who founded a settlement there, even though officially Fucking wasn't actually inhabited for another 400 to 500 years after that. So the history's a little bit weird there.
Okay, so how do we get from Focko to Fucking then?
Well, Wikipedia tells me that the spelling just gradually evolved. There was a Latin spelling of his name, which was Fusinging. Talking about spelling on podcasts is really not a good idea, is it? but it moved like gradually over hundreds of years until in the 18th century, we see the first instance of it being referred to as fucking. And of course, the Austrian locals don't pronounce it as fucking. I believe it's more like fucking. So the latest evolution of the name to F-U-G-G-I-N-G doesn't change the pronunciation of the name so much for the locals, which is good, I think. And the mayor, Andrea Holzner, really hopes that this will be the end of it. She said to a regional newspaper, OOAN, "I can confirm that the village is being renamed. I really don't want to say anything more. We've had enough media frenzy about this in the past." I have a feeling she's going to be a little bit disappointed about the fact that the news of the name change has been like an enormous story this week. I think this is the story we all needed at the end of 2020, the antidote to heal all our troubles of the past year. There is something we're waiting to find out about whether or not the neighbouring hamlets of Oberfucking and Unterfucking are also going to change their name, but we'll keep you posted on that one. Of course, it's not the only European town with a funny name. I've got a few personal favourites. For example, Hell in Norway, Middelfart in Denmark, Anus in France, and of course, Wind Passing, also in Austria.
Wind Passing, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously about the wind passing.
I was going to say, it sounds quite poetic if you don't think about it as the other sort of wind. Well, thank you very much for that little tour, Dominic.
It's my pleasure. I'm here to report on the serious matters of Europe.
we have more lovely people to thank this week for keeping us in business. Huge thanks go to Agnes Powers, Marcel Syme, who I think is your colleague, Dominic.
Yeah, he's a director, an opera lovely opera director that I just worked with. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcel. And thank you, Tiro. Thank you, all three of you, for signing up to support us on patreon.com, a website what you can use to give us a couple of euros or dollars or pounds a month, or more if you fancy, to help us keep making this lovely little podcast. You also get access to our fancy exclusive Facebook group,
which has been particularly lovely lately, I thought. We've had some really interesting conversations, like about the evolution of the Brussels sprout becoming more tasty due to some clever Dutch farmers. And I like the comparison of who has the best passport illustrations in Europe. Yeah. Estonia definitely is coming up top, I think.
I also really liked, there was a great conversation going on this week about films and TV shows that supposedly have European characters in. And people saying, you know, like, I saw this Italian character in the show, except they're really obviously not from those countries. It's so obvious. And why is it so stereotyped? I found it very amusing and interesting. So if you would like to join in the fun, you can chip in at patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
Time for an interview. Who are we speaking to today, Katie?
We are speaking to Oda Chihovles. She's a journalist based in Moscow, a former colleague of mine, future colleague of mine as well. I'm going back to work at AFP in January. Every so often when we're doing the research for the show, we come across a story that just seems to encapsulate a large chunk of European history, really. And today's interview is about one of those stories. Oda recently lost her grandmother, Janina. She died at the age of 95. And Oda told Janina's story in a Twitter thread that both of us found really moving. It's just a beautiful story. Spoiler alert, it does involve a Pole and an Italian falling in love in a Nazi camp. So it's definitely one for the romantics out there. Oda describes her grandma as a real unsung hero, and we just wanted to hear more about her. So here on the line is Oda.
Thank you for joining us today, Ola. We invited you to come and speak today because we read your beautiful Twitter thread about your grandmother, who sadly died recently at the age of 95. There are a plethora of incredible facts about her extraordinary sounding life, and we'll get to them very soon. But before we do, I wanted to ask you, what was she like as a grandmother? How do you remember spending time with her?
She was extremely, extremely warm and just always reading and kind of weirdly intellectual in a way, but also she was someone that never had a proper education. She was a teenager during the war, so she never finished even her basic education. So I think she finished school when she was about 15 and never went back to full-time education afterwards. But she was, despite that, just extremely well-read, an excellent writer. And yeah, constantly reading and really attentive to every member of her large family. Yeah, she was just amazing.
So she was born in 1925 in what was Poland at the time, but isn't Poland anymore, right?
Yeah, so she was born in a small village in what's now Western Ukraine and was at the time, just before the war, it was Poland. But she didn't really remember growing up there because I think she was about five when she went back to Warsaw. So Warsaw was where she grew up, and she was such a proud Varsovian and just loved her city so much. And yeah, saw it through lots of different periods, lots of different regimes.
And her family were not Jewish, but they lived in the kind of the heart of Jewish Warsaw. And something extraordinary happened when she was a child, when her family took in a stranger. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I actually thankfully sat down with her for like a long interview a couple of months before she died, and I wanted to find out the details about exactly how that happened. The Warsaw Ghetto Wall was literally just outside their window, so she saw a lot of her schoolmates on the other side, and she said it was really traumatic, obviously. And one day, a man from the ghetto, who I think was a friend of her older brother's, brought in a 9-year-old little girl who was his niece and asked if she could stay. And my great-grandmother sort of called the family together, and they all agreed to take this little girl in. And when the Warsaw Uprising began in 1944, they lost touch with her because their house was destroyed and all of my grandmother's family members were sent to different camps around Germany. they always wondered what had happened to her for years and years. My grandmother and her sister, my great aunt, would talk about her. One of my relatives, my cousin, decided to go and find out what happened to her. And he miraculously found this now elderly woman who lives in Paris. They were reunited, my grandmother and her great aunt. And I think this was about 2015. Yeah, it was quite an emotional time for all of them.
I bet. What a crazy story. So going back to 1944, it's the Warsaw Uprising staged by the Polish resistance. And if you don't know about this bit of the war, it was in fact the largest military effort by any European resistance movement. And the idea was to liberate Warsaw from the Nazis, but it failed. And in a terrible revenge, that the Nazis basically destroyed Warsaw. They razed a lot of it to the ground. And your grandma, I know she got sent to a Nazi camp for taking part in the uprising. What was her role in it?
She was making grenade like bags for the partisans. So she was more in sort of the logistics side of it, I suppose, like a lot of women were. But that part of her life, I mean, the uprising, just it never really left her. She would talk about it a lot. I guess it was a very traumatic part of her life.
What kind of things would she talk about?
She actually, one of the most interesting parts was that how a German soldier saved her life in Warsaw. She was running away with her sister. There was an air raid, a German air raid, and they didn't know where to hide. And one German soldier just grabbed them and took them to safety. She would talk about how she saw the uprising boys like standing by the wall, like ready, about to get shot by some Nazi patrols. And then when the uprising failed and the Nazis made most of Warsaw's population walk to camps just outside Warsaw, where they would be separated, some going to concentration camps, some going to labor camps. Some obviously managed to stay in Warsaw. And I think that was very traumatic for her, just walking through her entire city. That was just complete rubble. They were made to walk to a town outside Warsaw called Pruszków, which is where she got separated from all her family members, and that's where she got sent to a labor camp in Germany.
So obviously being in a labor camp in Germany was also a traumatic thing and an awful thing, and I don't want to suggest that there could be a silver lining to this, but she did have a happy experience in that camp, in that she met someone and fell in love. What do you know about the person that she fell in love with?
I don't know a huge amount about him, even though I kind of grew up with her talking about how wonderful he was all my life. Yeah, so she ended up in this labor camp, which was obviously terrible conditions and everything, but she always talked about the happy side of it, in that she was made to fix the plane seats for German aircraft. It was a huge factory, and she was working on a conveyor belt right next to her. This Italian prisoner was working alongside her, and they ended up falling completely in love. He was called Rossano. And they had plans to get married after the war, and he was teaching her Italian. And then just before the camp was liberated by the US Army, she and some friends actually thought it was a good moment to try and escape the camp. They started running away. And at this point, she thinks it might have actually been an American plane, flew down low and started firing at them, probably thinking that they were German guards. She ended up being shot quite badly through the thigh. Then she got rescued by US soldiers and got taken to a field hospital. And at this point, her plan was, I'll recover and then I'll get on the first train to Rome and marry this guy. At this point, the Italian had visited her in hospital, but all Italian soldiers had to go back to Italy. So he went back to Italy and told her to come straight to Rome when she could. She did get on a train. She had to get off the train because her leg was really badly swollen and had obviously not healed, and she wasn't well enough. And at that point, on the platform, there were a group of Polish soldiers who said that they would take care of her. One of them ended up being my grandpa. She never made it to Rome because they all took her to another hospital where doctors said that she wouldn't be able to walk for months. And everyone, all the Polish soldiers, all her family were saying, you know, it's ridiculous. You're going to go to Italy. marry someone that's not Polish. Anyway, everyone talked her out of it, but she always said, you know, getting out of that train changed my life.
What was her life like after the war?
So then they went back to Poland, where everything was obviously very grey and Stalinism had just started. So they went back to a completely different country. They were considering emigrating to Canada, but she always said that she missed the taste of Polish pickles. So she was like, can't live without that, and all of the US the food that they were receiving from the Americans. She said it put her off America for life. Yeah, so they went back to Poland. She married this Polish soldier. My grandpa had actually just come back from Buchenwald, so he was like a completely broken man. She managed to get a job as a nursery school teacher. She spent the rest of her life surrounded by children. She had four children in a small apartment in Warsaw. So it was quite tough, but she was always very resilient. And meanwhile, she started secretly learning Italian. She never forgot about this Italian. They had quite a turbulent, unhappy marriage. They were obviously not right for each other. And after my grandpa died in, I think, late 70s, early 80s, she met up with a distant relative who was a Catholic priest and had permission to leave Poland and go to Rome. And he miraculously found him. From then on, he wrote postcards to her every week. At this point, my grandma was already a grandma, and her grandkids were picking up these postcards from this Italian man. Everyone was very probably confused about it. He sent her a postcard saying, should I come over or will you? And she went to Rome, and they were very much in love. And he showed her around the whole of Italy. And yeah, she was very, very happy at this point.
Did they have a few years where they were kind of together then?
Not really. I mean, they were both grandparents at this point, and they would visit each other, but they weren't sort of a couple. But yeah, every time my mum emigrated to London in the early 80s, and every time my grandmother would come to London, she would watch Italian TV.
What impact do you think having Janina as a grandmother, what impact do you think that had on your own life?
I guess she was just like our moral compass. She always seemed to believe in the good of people, even in the darkest times. And her story also made me want to become a journalist, because just hearing all these amazing stories from different periods of her life and realizing there are so many untold stories out there from people who are just ordinary people who have so much impact on others.
What an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today. I imagine you're going to be getting like approaches from Hollywood movie producers that want to dramatize her life before long.
But, yeah, a few people have told me this should be a film.
Maybe it should be our first Europeans podcast movie production, Kate.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, great. We'll get on that. Thank you so much to Ola for taking the time to talk to us today. You should follow her on Twitter, where she posts about Russian things, Polish things, and other things. We will post a link in the show notes.
Time for some isolation inspiration. This week, I'm recommending something for Dutch speakers. The TV channel VPRO have made a documentary series called A Program About the 90s, or Een Programma Over de Jaren 90. And the first episode is all about Eurodance, this genre of electronic dance music that originated in the late 80s. And it's a really fun show, and actually really surreal in the way it's produced. If you don't speak Dutch, then why don't you go on a nostalgia trip and have a dance around your flat to some of Eurodance's biggest hits? Can you name any Eurodance hits, Katie?
Are we talking 90s?
Late 80s, early 90s, yeah.
Ooh, not really. A bit before my time. I'm very young.
Well, I think officially Aqua and the Venga Boys count as Eurodance. But
what about Gasolina?
No, I think that's too late. That's noughties, isn't it?
Is it?
But bands like La Bouche were particularly popular in that time. Lots of Europeans out there will remember this one. Be my lover, wanna be my lover. And I'm going to leave a link to a playlist so you can all go back and remember the hits of the 90s in Europe. There's some really special stuff in there.
Fun.
What have you been enjoying this week, Katie?
I watched the first three episodes of Love and Anarchy, the new Swedish comedy series on Netflix, and I found it very watchable. Quite weird, but watchable. I don't know if you've heard about it.
No, I haven't. I've been looking for a new series.
So it's set in a publishing company in Stockholm, and it's about this publishing consultant called Sophie, who is successful but bored, I would say. And she enters into this quite intriguing relationship with the IT guy, where they dare each other to do crazy things in the office. It's quite a weird one because she's not that sympathetic a character, necessarily. You see her being quite mean to colleagues and stuff like that. And I usually like my protagonists to be reasonably likable. But it is quite a good setup for comedy. And for some reason, I always find series set in publishing companies like really relaxing.
Mm.
I watched a Korean series last year that was set in a publishing company. Sorry for those of you who work in publishing. It's probably not very, very relaxing. But it looks that way to us. I think it's just like seeing one of these books on the screen just really zenned me out. But anyway, yeah, I wouldn't describe it as the best series I've watched all year. But it is quite fun. And if you are looking for something that is light and watchable with like slightly darker undertones, I think it's quite a good one.
You know, the thing I've actually been watching that I was thinking about when you were talking about police brutality in France is Watchmen. Finally, I'm getting around to watching it. Have you watched it?
No. Should I?
Yes. I mean, I'm really not someone who's into superhero or comic strip based. I don't even know what to call it, do I? It's not Marvel, it's DC. It's from the DC universe. But it's about racism in America and also about police brutality, and the police all wear masks so they can't be recognised.
Ah, very relevant for this week.
Yeah.
If you are after other recommendations for things to watch and read during this long, dark winter, that's another really good conversation that was happening on our Patreon group. People just chipping in with loads of really good podcast recommendations and series and things like that. So come on in, join us. Give us a happy ending, would you?
Yes, I will. So, running, it can be a wonderful thing, especially now when we're all inside so much.
You've got into it recently.
I have got into it recently, but when I go running, I don't expect to discover anything unique or newsworthy in the natural environment that I'm passing through. Unlike Archie Thomas, who was running through an ancient wooded area in Wiltshire when he came across an apple.
Okay.
Now, if I came across an apple, I think I'd just see it as an apple. But he saw this apple and thought, this looks like something quite unusual. It had this yellowy bulbous shape. And he thought, maybe this is a special apple and maybe I should look into this properly. And maybe he had this observation because he works for the charity Plant Life, which is a wild plant and fungi conservation charity. Not a fruit expert, but he does know a lot more than plebs like you and me, Katie.
Hey, rude.
Seeing as he works at a plant charity, he could immediately go home and ask his colleagues what he should do next. And they directed him to the plant identification team at the Royal Horticultural Society. Yes, that exists. Their specialist confirmed Archie's suspicion that it was indeed an unknown species of apple.
Ooh.
And it seemed to be a cross between a cultivated apple and a wild European crab apple. I got a bit stuck in the apple rabbit hole this week, and it turns out that apples are fascinating. Did you know that they almost all have originally had two parents from different types of seed, and that the apples we eat in the shops are all propagated through cuttings and not grown from seed, because otherwise they'd all come out differently?
I don't understand. So I'm not very good at gardening, but that does sound interesting. Yes.
So basically, if you want to grow an apple tree with the species of apple that we eat, then you have to cut a bit off from the tree.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Use a cutting. You can't do it just by planting the seeds of that apple. That won't work.
Because it'll make a new, different type of apple.
Or it won't make any apple, most likely.
Wow.
Anyway, the crux of this story is that it's very difficult to find a new variety of apple in nature without some human intervention. Really unusual. When it happens, it's called chance seedlings, and they sometimes happen because someone has chucked like the core of an apple out of their car and it's landed conveniently somewhere, and some magical nature stuff happens. You can tell I'm a really experienced scientist again.
Science, everyone!
But in this case, the experts think it actually happened over 100 years ago and there was no car involved.
Do we know what it tastes like, this new fancy apple?
Archie described it to The Guardian as tart, but not wincingly so, and with enough sweetness to eat raw. Not the most delicious sounding description, but edible at least.
Why wouldn't I eat it raw?
Yeah, actually, apparently, like, they describe it as a dual function apple. Wow. I'm getting very technical now, which means that it can be eaten raw or cooked. It's like somewhere in between a cooking apple and a normal apple. Archie is now considering what he should call it, because that is his responsibility as the discoverer of the apple. His 7-year-old son wants it to be called Cristiano Ronaldo. Please no. And his wife is called Hannah, and he said that she is the apple of his eye.
Aww.
So Hannah is in contention.
Thank you for listening to us, Wittering On, again for yet another week. I hope this was a good accompaniment to your lockdown walk, cleaning the bathroom, or whatever you were doing.
Did you notice that our listener numbers have ticked back up after we had a suspicious dip around the American election?
Oh, really?
Yeah, anyway, I'm glad you're all back. And frankly, I can't blame you for being a bit distracted by that hot mess of an election. But there's lots happening in Europe. So tell all your friends about our podcast. We love it when people tweet about us almost as much as we love it when people join us on Patreon. And we are at Europeans Pod on Twitter. Does this sound desperate? I'm feeling needy.
Yes, we are on Twitter. We're also on Instagram at Europeans Podcast, and we're on Facebook. If you just type in the Europeans Podcast, you should find us. Or you can send us an email, one-on-one communication, hello@europeanspodcast.com.
We'll be back next Wednesday, as usual, with more tales of the continent, or maybe one specific tale next week.
Maybe. Stay tuned. See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Cheers.